This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan. In January of 2005, Professor Dr. Rahina Ibrahim, a Malaysian doctorate student in Stanford at the time, was arrested at the San Francisco International Airport, where she was told that she had been labeled a terrorist suspect in a U.S. government database, a database popularly referred to as the no-fly list.
The New York Times reports the federal government's terrorist watch list, officially called the Terrorist Screening Database, has grown to at least 700,000 people, and those on the list are often subjected to extra scrutiny, prohibited from flying, interrogated while attempting to cross borders. According to the article, Who's Watching the Watch List? The government refuses to divulge who's on the list, how one can get off the list, and what criteria is used to place someone on the list in the first place. Oftentimes, people have no idea their names in the database until they attempt to board a flight.
Professor Dr. Ibrahim was subsequently barred from entering the country and had to complete her Stanford University doctorate studies remotely. Now, 8 years later, she has won the case against the U.S. federal government in what will undoubtedly be a landmark ruling against the no-fly list. On January 14, 2014, U.S. District Judge William Alsup in San Francisco sided with Professor Dr. Ibrahim and ruled that existing procedures to correct mistakes on that list do not provide adequate due process protection. Today on the Evening Edition, we speak to her lawyer, Elizabeth Pipkin of the law firm McManus Faulkner, who undertook Rahina's case, pro bono, I might add. Could you give us some background into how this came about in the first place, this case? I mean, did Rahina approach you directly?
So Rahina was referred to us as someone who had a potential matter, and we looked into her matter and decided that she had a worthwhile case. She wanted us to represent her, and we wanted to represent her, so we moved forward.
And I'm just curious as to how you came to that conclusion of worthwhile, because obviously there are so many people on the no-fly list, and there are so many people who've tried doing this. And what made Rahina's case different, or what made you think, oh, we've got something here?
Well, if you meet Rahina, you can see that she's a very sincere person and someone who has a lot of esteem and is highly praised by those who know her. And it was clear that what had happened to her at the San Francisco airport, that something just was not right because she was let go without explanation and she was never charged with a crime. So it seemed that there was just something not right about the way she'd been treated. But it's true that we did not have all of the facts about why this had happened to her.
Right. So I guess there's something to be said for gut feeling then.
I would say so, yes.
Now, it was reported that both you and your team of lawyers handled the case pro bono. And
yes,
of course, you know, that's something, given that over 11,000 hours were put into this case and must have cost the firm quite a bit of money. So why did you decide to do that pro bono?
This firm has a long history of prosecuting civil rights cases. It's not all we do. We also represent a lot of companies in Silicon Valley, as well as individuals who have business matters. But we do think it is very important, and it is our obligation as attorneys to also take on matters for free that advance important values, and we viewed her case as one of those cases.
And have you handled a case like this before, or has your firm handled something so involved with the government on this level?
We've handled many civil rights cases against the government, but this takes the cake for the longest case. We have not had a case that lasted this long and that involved this many appeals.
Right. Let's get into the case proper. We've read quite a bit about it. I mean, I believe, you know, Wired magazine's covered it in great detail. A lot of press outlets in the U.S. have. Can you just explain the nitty-gritties of this case and how it came about? We all know Rahina was arrested. She had just come out of surgery at the time. She was in a wheelchair. It's one of those very, I would say, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny. You know, here's a woman from a minority. What's more, she's in a wheelchair, and then she gets hassled at an airport. It's like a perfect storm of nonsense.
Yes, it was just one bad thing after the next for her. On January 2nd, 2005, she was attempting to fly from the San Francisco airport to a conference in Hawaii, and then she planned to continue on from there to Malaysia. And from the moment she stepped into the airport, it was just one problem after the next. She was arrested without any explanation. The officials who arrested her attempted to search under her hijab, which was, of course, very offensive for someone who is a devout Muslim, as Dr. Ibrahim is. And she was in great pain because she was recovering from hysterectomy surgery. She was eventually let go and told that she could fly the next day, which she did. However, when she tried to return to Stanford to finish her dissertation, she was told at the airport in Kuala Lumpur that she would not be allowed to fly and that her student visa, which was supposed to be valid, had been revoked.
And, of course, her daughter as well was put on a no-fly list and was not allowed to fly.
Yes, so her daughter, the specifics of her daughter's case are largely under seal at this point, so I cannot speak too much about the specifics.
Right.
But what I can speak about is what was publicly available, which is that Dr. Ibrahim's daughter attempted to fly to the United States to attend the trial in this case and was not allowed to do so because of an email that was sent by the United States Department of Homeland Security.
I'm speaking to Elizabeth Pipkin from the San Jose law firm McManus Faulkner. She and her team were responsible for successfully representing Professor Dr. Rahina Ibrahim in her case against the U.S. federal government for putting her on a terrorist no-fly list. After this, we get into the case proper. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
This is the Evening Edition, and I am Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan. Professor Dr. Rahina Ibrahim is a Malaysian citizen who found herself on a U.S. terror no-fly list that has prevented her from entering the country since 2005. Here's Anya Bernstein, an associate law professor at SUNY Buffalo Law School, on just what Professor Dr. Ibrahim was facing.
She showed up at the airport, she was told she couldn't board, and then she was arrested by the San Francisco police. The FBI told them to let them go, and she was allowed to board a plane the next day, flew to Malaysia, but was not allowed to go back. And later she was informed that her student visa was revoked. Now, one thing to realize in a legal sense is that the revocation of her visa is not something that is reviewable by a judge. There's no oversight over visa granting or revocation whatsoever. So she can't sue about that. But she can sue about being on the no-fly list and not being allowed to board aircraft, because that affects actually her ability to travel to a lot of places and not just to the U.S. She can't board a U.S. aircraft, and she also can't fly over U.S. airspace. Aside from that, we share our terrorist database lists with at least 22 other countries, possibly more. And it's a fair presumption that a lot of those countries will not let her fly as well. So those are the harms she's seeking to redress. One of the reasons that the case has taken so long is that the government has opposed her ability to try the case at all. So in other words, they haven't even started arguing about the merits. So far, they've been fighting about whether the court has jurisdiction to hear the case in the first place. So that went up to the Ninth Circuit on appeal and went back down to the district court. The government has also challenged her standing to sue the case, claiming that there's no real injury that she has suffered, and anyway, whatever relief the court can grant her wouldn't redress the injury. So those are that's what standing means, is you have to have an injury and the judgment has to redress the injury. And that went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit agreed that she had standing, and now it's back down before the district court.
That was a clip from democracynow.org. They spoke to Anya Bernstein about Professor Dr. Ibrahim's case back in December 2013. Today, however, we're speaking to Elizabeth Pipkin of the law firm McManus Faulkner. She and her team represented Professor Dr. Ibrahim in her case against the U.S. government, pro bono, for the last 8 years. Now, what was the eventual outcome? Because obviously, at one point, I guess the judge, Judge Alsup, dismissed the case. And then a federal appeals court reinstated it in 2012. What changed? It was more than a year after he had dismissed the case.
Yes. So actually, there was that appeal that you just mentioned, and there was also a previous appeal. The case was actually dismissed twice by Judge Alsup, and our firm appealed it both times, and both times the higher court reversed that dismissal and sent the case back to trial in front of Judge Alsup. So in both of those cases, in both of those appeals, there were legal issues that the government claimed required dismissal of Dr. Ibrahim's case, and the government argued that it should not be heard on its merits. In both situations, the Ninth Circuit disagreed with that and said that she did have a right to her day in court.
And with regards to, I guess, Judge Alsup as well, I think there was a quote in a Wired article where he had uncovered or heard about the true facts behind how she got on that list and felt that he had been duped almost or been had by the government.
Yes, so the reference to the judge's quote about being had by the government was that the government tried to use another procedural tactic after it lost the two appeals to get the judge to dismiss the case, again, without hearing the merits of the case. And this was a reversal from their previous position, where they had represented that the evidence at issue would just be excluded from the case and that their position would not require dismissal. And so that was why the judge said he felt he'd been had, because the government reversed its position and made a last-ditch attempt to get the entire case dismissed, contrary to its previous stances.
Right. And can you tell us, because the government used, I guess, what was called a state secret privilege, and that was what they were using to stonewall the case, I guess. And can you tell us a little bit more about the state secret privilege that the government often employs?
Yes. The state secrets privilege is a doctrine that was established by the United States Supreme Court in the 1950s during the McCarthy era. And
everyone's favorite era.
Oh, yes, I know. Unfortunately, this case and others like it have a lot of, they're very reminiscent of that era. But the United States Supreme Court that established the doctrine held that there are certain situations where the government can assert that something is so important to national security that it cannot be disclosed in a lawsuit because that would pose a risk to security. But it's supposed to be used in very rare situations. It's supposed to be used only for the most important secrets that really would jeopardize the nation. The government attempted to assert that privilege in this case and said that the case could not be decided without getting into very secret information that should be protected by the state secrets doctrine. And the judge rejected that view.
Now, of course, I guess after 9/11, there has been a lot more at stake. So the government, I guess, feels the need or the necessity to use the privilege whenever it can. But when it comes to a decision like this, what do you see it happening more often? Or was the Judge Alsup case an anomaly because he had discovered this little, you know, he felt that he had been had?
Well, there are other judges who are going to be deciding the other cases, and so it's always when you come to the when you look at the judicial system, it's not necessarily easy to predict. But I think that it's becoming more recognized that the idea of putting people on a secret blacklist without any notice and opportunity to be heard violates the United States Constitution. Our founders believed in the concept of innocent until proven guilty. And if you are going to be deprived of your right to travel, then you deserve an opportunity to know why you're deprived of that right and an opportunity to rebut those allegations.
I'm speaking to Elizabeth Pipkin from the San Jose law firm McManus Faulkner. After this, we get a little philosophical about no-fly lists. Stay tuned to the evening edition on BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good evening. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampage Pagan. 8 years ago, Professor Dr. Rahina Ibrahim, a mother of four with a doctorate from Stanford University, was waiting to board a flight from San Francisco to Hawaii en route home to Malaysia, but was told she was on a no-fly list. She was arrested. She was interrogated. She was eventually cleared to fly to Malaysia, but her visa was revoked soon afterward, and she could not return to Stanford, where she was pursuing her degree. She was never told why she was put on that list, and in 2006, she sued the government to find out. So just what are the origins of these no-fly lists? Here's a brief history from Anya Bernstein, an associate law professor at SUNY Buffalo Law School.
These lists started in some sense in the 90s without really that much thought about terrorism. So, for instance, one of the lists that feeds into this master list is a list called the Violent Gang and Terrorist Organization File, run by the FBI. And that list was created as a violent gang file, so Crips and Bloods and that sort of thing. And at the last minute, the FBI thought, wouldn't it be nice to have terrorist suspects on here too? And included them under the same criteria as used for the violent gangs. And many of the lists developed in this kind of haphazard way. After 9/11, they became used a lot more, obviously, and people were paying a lot more attention to them. And the process by which they were consolidated was also somewhat haphazard. I think people in the government noticed that they were checking a lot of different lists, that there were contradictions, the criteria are different, and they decided to have a consolidated watch list in the early 2000s to kind of act as an umbrella over all of these.
That was a clip from democracynow.org. They spoke to Anya Bernstein about no-fly lists back in December 2013. Now here is one of Professor Dr. Rahina's attorneys, Marwa El-Zankali, laying out the case in front of a U.S. Court of Appeals judge.
We sued the TSA, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the Terrorist Screening Center, and the FBI. We basically sued anyone who was involved or could have been involved in Ms. Ibrahim's arrest and in her the placement of her name on the no-fly list.
Essentially, and your APA claim is simply to try to get her name off the no-fly list?
Correct.
That's the only relief you seek under the APA?
It's to take her name off of a government watch list. It's the same list that is being used, that is basically put together by the TSC and is used by every government agency who engages in any terrorist monitoring activities, including the TSA, but also including overseas consulates issuing visas, including local law enforcement agencies and state law enforcement agencies. And that list is distributed to many different agencies. It's not just used by the TSA.
Professor Dr. Ibrahim has since won her case against the U.S. federal government, becoming the first and only individual to have ever successfully challenged the notorious no-fly list. Today, I'm speaking to Elizabeth Pipkin from the San Jose law firm McManus Faulkner. She and her team represented Professor Dr. Rahina Ibrahim against the U.S. federal government. A lot of people call the no-fly list Kafkaesque, but even Joseph K. got a trial.
That's correct. And the government has tried to deprive individuals contesting their status of a trial. And it's absolutely Kafkaesque. It's Orwellian. It's any number of similar words you could come up with to describe it. But in this country, we do have judges and courts who are there to put a check on the power of the executive. And that's what Judge Alsup and hopefully some of these other judges will do as well.
Now, this is a pretty big deal. I mean, it's been the first person not just to have been allowed to challenge the no-fly list, but also a victory. What does this mean for other such cases? What precedent have you set?
What it means is that a court can look at what the executive branch has done and order the executive branch to take a different action, or to remove someone's name from a list, or to correct errors in the government's information. And this is extremely important to ensure the rights of all Americans. When you have a government power that has unfettered discretion, history shows that that does not turn out well, and that that is anti-democratic.
And when it comes to the nitty-gritties of this case, do you think there are, I guess, some universal aspects of your particular case that other, I guess, victims of the list can latch on to and probably use to their advantage?
I certainly think so, and there are others who will, I'm sure, use this precedent to in their cases that are pending in other parts of the country.
So I was reading about the actual details of the case and also the actual decision itself. It's quite funny because it was entirely human error. An FBI agent ticked the wrong box.
Well, that was certainly what the government admitted. There is a lot we still do not know or understand about why Agent Kelly did what he did. Although I think the government would want to portray this as an isolated mistake.
That one person.
That one person just did this, and maybe this was just an isolated error.
It's funny because if you go to the FBI website and read their FAQs, they admit to making hundreds of errors and that they're constantly correcting the list.
Absolutely. These lists are well known for their error rates, and numerous government reports have spotlighted that. And these error rates have been documented even for records that have been reviewed multiple times by agency staff. The policies of the entities that put together these lists are part of the problem. It's basically assumed that once someone's investigated, that they're going to be placed on one of these watch lists. So it's almost like there's a presumption, which again goes against the whole concept of innocent until proven guilty that we're supposed to believe in this country.
And, you know, I mean, the case aside, just to talk about the philosophical with regards to no-fly list and exactly what you were saying about presumption of innocence, there are supposedly 500,000 people or 500,000 people on this list at the moment. Are any of them given a chance to actually work with the authorities to prove their innocence, or is it just a given that you accept your fate?
The government wants it to be a given that you accept your fate, and that's where the constitutional violation is occurring, because there is no access to the officials who make these decisions. Dr. Ibrahim tried for 8-9 years to get to the bottom of this, understand why she was on, why these actions occurred, and she was never able to penetrate through the bureaucracy, even after filing this lawsuit.
Yeah.
So the problem is that your normal person who fills out a form and sends it off to this some nameless bureaucrat in Washington D.C. Never has the opportunity to understand why this happened and to explain the truth to that person.
Because we actually don't have a specific set of reasons as to why someone even gets on the list, right?
Exactly. And after you send in your form asking for relief, then you get back a very cryptic letter that says something like, well, we've reviewed your records, and if there was a mistake, we've corrected it. If there was a problem, it's been remedied. But you never know if there was a problem, if it actually has been remedied, or why there was a problem.
And so the only time you'd ever find out if you were in an airport and get questioned and stopped and arrested.
Exactly.
Okay, wow, that's quite depressing. When it comes to Rahina, it has been reported that the judge is set to unseal a larger judicial order that discloses whether she was actually indeed on a watch list and has given the government until April 15th, I believe. Now, if Rahina's name is on that list, what happens afterwards?
Well, I wouldn't presume to predict anything. When we filed this case in 2006, I don't think any of us would have predicted it would have taken 8 years for a resolution, or that this case would have taken the twists and turns that it has. We very much hope that the United States government will let Dr. Ibrahim return, give her a visa so that she can collaborate with colleagues here and build ties between Malaysia and the United States.
So at the moment, despite the victory, she still can't come back into the United States?
Well, that's up to the United States government. I am an optimist, and I would never say never. I hope that they will give her a visa. But one of the things that the judge said in his opinion was that he does not have the power to review the government's decision to grant or deny her a visa. And so even though the government has acknowledged that she's not a threat to the United States, it's certainly a possibility that the U.S. government would not allow her a visa to enter.
Before I let you go, just a couple more questions about the no-fly list itself. Is it your opinion that the no-fly lists themselves are unconstitutional, or the inability to challenge them is unconstitutional? Because I think that's the big debate, isn't it?
It is. I think certainly the inability to challenge them is unconstitutional, and I think as long as you have a system where you're not able to challenge it, it would be unconstitutional. It is conceivable that the government could potentially build a system that allows people the proper protections that would comply with the Constitution, but that hasn't been done yet, and until it is done, the system does not comply with the Constitution.
All right. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time. That's been very enlightening.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Elizabeth Pipkin from the San Jose law firm McManus Faulkner. She and her team of lawyers have done a remarkable job in standing up for the civil rights of a woman who wasn't even a citizen of their country. Incredible stuff, I tell you. You're listening to the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.